Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sealed indictment of the first arrest by the special counsel investigating possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, the target of which is expected to be revealed on Monday. Joining us to discuss the procedures involved as the Mueller investigation moves towards indictments is Harry Litman, a former United States attorney and deputy assistant U.S. Attorney General. We'll speculate on who the first target might be and assess the furious backlash from Trump's Republican surrogates and the flurry of angry tweets coming from a president who routinely blames Obama and Hillary Clinton for everything and anything. Although Clinton lost the election and Trump won and is president, she is now being dredged up as Trump turns history on its head by accusing Clinton of colluding with Putin, who hates her, as he brings up the 33,000 emails that he called upon Russia to hack, as well as referring to the Comey fix as though the person who many, including Clinton, consider the main reason she lost the presidency was in collusion with her. Then we'll go to Moscow to speak with Russian defense analyst Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, whose daughter Tatyana was deputy editor-in-chief, is deputy editor-in-chief of the only opposition radio in Russia, Echo Moskvy. She was stabbed in the neck and almost died. He joins us to discuss the constant danger that journalists who oppose the Putin line face in an environment of propaganda-induced hyper-nationalism, with government media branding critics of the Putin regime enemies of the people and American spies. We'll also discuss how the U.S. nuclear buildup announced on Friday by Vice President Pence will play into Putin's hands. Then finally, with over 300,000 people demonstrating in Barcelona today in support of the Spanish government, we'll go to Spain to discuss the volatile political standoff between Catalonia and Spain following a declaration of independence by the Catalan government on Friday, then the firing of the Catalan government by Madrid. Francisco Rodriguez Jimenez, a professor of global and international studies at the University of Salamanca, Spain, joins us to discuss the popular backlash to the independence referendum, which around 40% of Catalans voted for, and the Spanish government tried to stop with a heavy-handed crackdown. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney General appointed by President Bill Clinton and the Deputy Assistant Attorney General, who currently teaches at UCLA Law School and practices law at Constantine Cannon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Harry. And obviously, we'd be speculating, as everybody else is, I might add, who the target or targets of the sealed indictments that are expected to be unsealed on Monday. Why don't we start with that? What's your sense of who the target or targets might be?
Well, one thing you can be sure of is that the target himself or herself has been notified in advance. That's DOJ policy that Mueller would certainly have followed. And once the indictment itself has been returned, there should be a specific advice given to the target to arrange for a surrender and the like. We know of only one person who's publicly revealed, or as to whom it's been publicly revealed that they are a target. That's Paul Manafort. That likely came from Manafort himself, and that obviously puts him in the list of in the small list for tomorrow. My best guess is it's not Manafort. It would be unusual to be aiming so high so soon. The somewhat remarkable thing is we haven't heard who it is, even though the person himself knows. If I were betting, I would probably bet on Michael Flynn for reasons I'll go into. But the main thing I want to emphasize, Ian, is I think what matters more tomorrow is not who's indicted, but what they are indicted for. There are three discrete lines of investigation that Mueller is pursuing, and whether this indictment falls in the obstruction of justice line, in the specific campaign line, or in the line of activities and misdeeds in Russia dating back many years is really going to be the biggest tell of where the investigation is going and on whom Mueller is looking to exert immediate pressure.
So explain why you think it might be General Flynn.
Sure. I think Flynn is the most sort of straightforward target, and it would be because we know he was interviewed by the FBI several times. We know he's a serial liar about the nature of his conversations in the transition period with Ambassador Kislyak. And he likely repeated those same lies to the FBI. He likely told them, no, we didn't discuss anything about substance or specific policy vis-a-vis Russia. That is a sort of neat and provable offense lying to the FBI. He may also have some easily provable offenses involving his failure to register as a lobbyist, involving his payments from Turkey. He's a liar. He's brash and outspoken. There's no love lost between him and pretty much all of Washington. And there seem to be only about eight or nine people, and that maybe a dozen if you count the president and his family members. And as you go through the list, his offense seems the most sort of discreet and easy to prove at this point. It's only been 5 months since the investigation started.
Sure.
That's a very quick out of the gate, even though it seems long for us. But compared to other independent counsel inquiries, so you expect it to be a relatively straightforward charge. And that's what leads me to focus on Flynn.
Well, Donald Trump and his surrogates are certainly going on the offensive. Donald Trump is furiously tweeting out, "Never seen such Republican anger and unity in caps as I have concerning the lack of investigation on Clinton. The uranium to Russia deal, the 33,000-plus deleted emails, the Comey fix, and so much more." And then he goes on, "Instead, they look at phony Russia-Trump collusion, which doesn't exist. The Democrats are using this terrible and bad for our country witch hunt for evil politics. But the Republicans are now fighting back like never before. There is so much guilt in caps by Democrats, Clinton. And now the facts are pouring out. Do something," with exclamation in caps. So
Quite a logorrheic tweet, even for him, isn't it?
It is, as I mentioned in the opening, it is so crazy. I am astounded that this core support in this sort of Fox News, Sinclair, Rush Limbaugh bubble, that they honestly believe Trump, and they don't believe the rest of the press. But everything
right.
is being turned on its head. I mean,
it is kind of crazy top to bottom, isn't it? Although my sense of this, nothing happens without coordination and tacit approval from the White House. It's true that his tweets are, particularly vituperative, but they don't go directly after Mueller. By contrast, the surrogates who are out there now have begun to sound the drumbeat about Mueller in particular. And my sense is that there's a grand strategy to try to, begin again to go after Mueller and, a few months or even more down the line to set up, give Trump maximum leverage to lower the boom if he wants to. But when Fox News and certain congressmen are out there with similar talking points, I think it's a safe bet that they wasn't done in a vacuum, and someone in the communication shop, including working with the legal staff of the president, has approved it.
Well, we know that Donald Trump speaks with Rupert Murdoch, the head of Fox,
right.
almost every day. And it's pretty clear that Fox is beginning a campaign, which I'm sure Sinclair and Limbaugh and others will echo, to discredit the special counsel. And is this to lay the groundwork for a preemptive pardon?
So that's an interesting question. How I've written about the possibility of his trying to fire Mueller down the line, and I don't think it's a feasible alternative now. But what about an aggressive use of the pardon power? In some ways, no action of his was more quixotic and arrogant than the pardon of Arpaio. There's a whole protocol at DOJ he completely ignored the recommendation from DOJ, went for a cheap political hit, obviously sees the pardon power as a little, you know, as a toy in his sandbox. What about his pardoning whoever is indicted tomorrow? Now, there's a lot of complicated deliberations there, and it would certainly be an absolute declaration of war against Mueller. But given Trump's view of the pardon power as a kind of personal plaything, it's something you have to put into the possible considerations that they're reflecting on.
Well, there is some low hanging fruit, though, that Mueller could go after. And I mean, you mentioned General Flynn. I mean, he actually, according to a former head of the CIA, he was in on a meeting. Flynn met with emissaries of the Turkish autocrat Erdogan, and agreed or offered his services to do a rendition of the controversial cleric here as a U.S. Resident in Pennsylvania, right, to literally, grab him and spirit him off to Canada and fly him out of the country. Unbelievable illegality. So and then you got Roger Stone, who just got banned from Twitter today. And then you've got this peculiar alliance of coincidence upon coincidence between Nigel Farage, who visited with Donald Trump and then went to see Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in the WikiLeaks founder in London. And they're both friends with Stephen Bannon and Mercer, particularly Farage. Cambridge Analytica apparently helped the referendum, Brexit, to succeed. And of course, Farage is paid for, he's on the payroll of RT, the Russian broadcaster. And then, you've got Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, who's also a friend of Farage's. And he's also met with Donald Trump Jr.'s lawyer, Veselnitskaya. And he also, Dana Rohrabacher, visited Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy, and of course, one of the top guys in the House, Kevin McCarthy, in a meeting with Paul Ryan and other top Republicans, said, "I swear to God, Putin and Dana Rohrabacher are on Putin's payroll." So, I mean, what the hell is going on here?
Like two points. Yes, a tangled web for sure. I would just make two points about that particular scenario that you've just laid out. The first is, from Trump's point of view, there's no such thing as low-hanging fruit in the sense that the immediate issue is what lies above on the tree. So it might be small stuff that doesn't get at him, but the question is, what can that person help get at the next level above? The second would be, if any of these fellows are indicted tomorrow, that would be relatively good news for Trump, in the sense that it would indicate the current line of inquiry is the whole WikiLeaks bizarre adventure. And as to that, the facts are relatively clear, and Trump's fingerprints, I shouldn't even say fingerprints, Trump's involvement is there's not much reason to believe he was calling the shots there. Much more ominous for him would be an indictment, the subject matter of which focuses on Russian financial misdeeds, pre-campaign, or the collusion in the transition. And most ominous of all would be an indictment that looks to the potential obstruction of justice count, for instance, of someone who was present at the Comey
interactions in the White House. That would signal a target many fewer steps removed from the president.
Well, there's a whole list of people that would fit all of the above, right?
Yes.
Well, I think...
And again, I just want to emphasize, none of it, you know, it's pretty impressive, actually, that it hasn't come out in Washington over a whole Washington weekend. But the main point that I think bears emphasis is, look at the content of the indictment tomorrow, what episodes are involved, and what they might augur about who the defendant could give information on. That's the really telling point.
Well, Harry Litman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Harry Litman, who's a former United States attorney appointed by President Bill Clinton. He was also Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the United States, and he currently teaches at UCLA Law School and practices law at Constantine Cannon. We're going to take a brief station break and back and go to Moscow to speak with a Russian defense analyst whose daughter, the deputy editor of Moscow Echo Moscow, the opposition radio station, was recently stabbed in the neck and almost died.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us from Moscow is Dr. Pavel Felkenhauer, who is a defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences and published a regular column on defense in the English-language newspaper Moscow Times. And after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, he joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta, and now he's a regular commentator on Russia and appears in many other local and international publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felkenhauer.
Thank you.
Just to touch on your daughter, she's doing well, I take it. She was the deputy editor-in-chief on Echo Moscow, independent radio station, just as you work for, I think, the last of the independent newspapers, Novaya Gazeta. She was also...
Yes, that's true.
But she's doing okay. She was attacked.
Well, she's recovering, and things could have been much worse.
Sure. Well, the atmosphere against journalists is really what creates these situations, isn't it? When mainstream commentators on the main television stations, the state-run pro-Putin media in Russia, when they talk about independent journalists like you and your daughter as enemies of the state, that does put a target on your back, doesn't it?
Well, there were a number of kind of just before the attack on my daughter Tanya, there was a number of feature stories on state TV about Echo Moskvy and her in particular being American agents of the State Department. A couple of programs are called The Echo of the State Department. So, yes, that America is the enemy, and those who the Kremlin does not like are American agents, kind of back to the USSR thing.
Well, that's been pretty effective, hasn't it, on Putin's part? He blames the economic problems on the American sanctions, which, of course, excuses the Siloviki and the oligarchs and all the looting of the treasury that goes on by this clique of kleptocrats running Russia. And if you go back to the horrible attack on the school children in the south in Beslan, Putin blamed that on the Americans. So is it the mindset going back to Glavny Protivnik, the idea of America is the main enemy as it was during the Cold War?
It's the Vyayatny Protivnik because that's basically the only enemy right now that Russia has. And it's more or less official nowadays. The time when it was, 10, 15 years, 20 years ago, when both Washington and Moscow declared that they're not enemies, that's past enemies again. And that's important for those fractions in the ruling elite that want more defense spending. And right now, most likely, it's important to Putin also personally, for he'll be running, apparently, his re-election campaign. There'll be presidential elections. Of course, there are pro forma elections in next March, but Putin will be most likely running on a kind of siege situation, a siege mentality that Russia is under attack, that war may be imminent, that the threat is growing, because the economy is not in a very good shape. Right? It's not Russia. It's stagnating. The incomes of households have been declining for about 4 years. Not that dramatically declining, but still declining, not growing as it was in the first decade of Putin's rule. And so since he can't placate the populace with economic growth and more income in the families, he's going to scare them with American threats that's because we have to all sacrifice, because we have to arm the nation, because the enemy is at the doorstep.
Well, here, of course, we are waiting Monday for the announcement on who the special prosecutor looking into possible Russian interference in the election. We don't know who it is. It could be one of the main people, either General Flynn or Paul Manafort or Roger Stone. But it's an extraordinary situation. My understanding is that many inside the intelligence establishment, particularly at the SVR, didn't think it was a good idea that Ivanov, Putin's chief of staff, was against it and got fired. But the GRU and the FSB seem to have been involved in manipulating the U.S. elections. We don't know the extent to which they were successful. But do you think that Putin has been too clever, that maybe having Trump elected president is not such a great idea? It may be a good idea if you want America to be weakened, because Trump is a catastrophe, a complete incompetent, and a reckless and dangerous person. So what's going on in the Kremlin? Are they wondering whether it was such a good idea to manipulate the American election?
Well, there was total euphoria last November after the election, when it turned out that Trump has become president-elect. There was great hopes that there's going to be some kind of quid pro quo with the new American regime, and that many problems could be solved, maybe all of them, that Russia would get its coveted sphere of influence, that Ukraine will be handed over, maybe other parts of Eurasia, and there's going to be some kind of grand deal, and everything's going to be just simply fine with a guy in the White House that isn't more or less our guy. And now it's all, of course, went sour. There's a lot of disappointment that Trump may be a good guy, but he's being totally outmaneuvered, that he's too weak, that he can't put through any kind of meaningful policies, and that the anti-Russian American establishment has won the day, and things are bad and grim. And as the internal interests right now point of a number of figures, including Putin, playing the American threat card right now is more important than kind of as a year ago or more, about a year ago. The card was different, that it's going to be a new America with a new relationship with Russia. So now, yes, everything's seen as very bad, that Trump can't deliver, and the relations are going to go from bad to worse.
Well, Trump, of course, is trying. He still seems to be doing what he can to stalling the imposition of this new round of sanctions that the Congress overwhelmingly voted for. But in terms of playing the enemy card, and that's more important now for Putin as he comes into the elections, and of course he does have this false candidate, Sobchak's daughter, that would help neutralize the opposition or split the opposition vote, even though it's small and controlled in what is referred to as managed democracy. The United States under Trump doesn't seem to be helping. They're actually making America more of an enemy, particularly in terms of the nuclear posture review. Just on Friday, Vice President Pence visited the Air Force base where the Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles are and the B-52 strategic bombers are, and he talked about our administration is committed to strengthen and modernize the nuclear deterrent. You can be assured that our administration is committed to strengthen and modernize America's nuclear deterrent, etc., etc. History attests the surest path to peace is through American strength. There's no greater element of American strength. There's no greater force for peace in the world than the United States nuclear arsenal. So we on this side are starting to rediscover nuclear weapons. So that's not likely to help matters, is it? Will that play into Putin's hands?
Well, it will play into the hands of the Russian military for sure, because Russia has been actually modernizing its nuclear deterrent and investing lots of money into that modernization. New submarines, new missiles are being developed, and some of them already deployed. New very long-range cruise missiles that's going to make the Russian strategic bomber fleet a force to be reckoned with again, because before we had long-range cruise that was just about 3,000 kilometers, so they had to fly deep into the Atlantic, say, or the Pacific to fire on America. Now we're going to have cruise missiles that are about 5,000 kilometers range, and maybe their range can be even more increased, so they can fly out with a fighter escort and fire from a much further away from the American interceptors. So the bomber forces are also being, and there's going to be, they'll be building new bombers. So, and that's the program. To get money for it, and there's problems with money as the economy is stagnating, and Putin is still very much about having a tight budget and not printing money. So there's quite a fight for money, and the more threat coming from America and the more pronouncements of above American military and politicians that they're strengthening their part will be very, very welcome to the Russian general staff and the Russian generals, because they could argue that they also need more money to deploy the new weapons that they have developed.
Well, one of the things that the new American Nuclear Posture Review is talking about, apparently, is a low-yield ballistic missile, which is supposed to deter Russia's use of small nuclear weapons, low-yield, I guess, tactical nuclear weapons, which the fear is that they could be used in Ukraine or even in the Baltics. Has Russia developed low-yield battlefield nuclear weapons?
Well, there were publications about that quite some time ago, that such weapons were more or less kind of developed or being developed. And Russia has the know-how to make a low-yield or regulated yield weapons, as does the United States. The real problem was delivery systems. It's not the weapons per se, but delivery systems, because right of the 1987 agreement, a treaty signed by Gorbachev and Reagan. Right now, all land-based missiles from 5,500 to 500 range are not allowed. So Russia would be developing new missiles. Maybe there's been talk, and Putin has been talking about for some time, that this treaty right now is under threat, and it from this treaty, actually, this so-called zero option, ended the Euro missile crisis of the 80s, is now under threat. So developing reliable delivery systems is the problem. The United States more relied on aircraft. Russia most likely understands that its bombers can hardly go far into enemy airspace without being shot down. So Russia always more relied on missiles. So the weapons, I believe, are not a problem. The warheads, the nuclear explosives, they're regulated and low yield. They can be produced by the Russian nuclear industry. So the problem is delivery systems,
which may be
developed, and for that you'd have to roll back the leftovers of the treaties that ended the Cold War. Well, effectively moving back into a new Cold War.
Well, yeah, the New START agreement restricts both sides to 1,550 deployed strategic warheads and bombs, but it's hanging by a thread. Now, when you mentioned earlier, Pavel Felgenhauer, that the Russians might develop a longer-range cruise missile, the U.S. could bring back the Tomahawk sea-launched cruise missile with a nuclear warhead. They stopped deploying them in 2013, so that would be an easy move on the U.S. part. So this is not a not a good direction that we're heading in. Is there anything on the horizon that you can see that could alter this trajectory towards a new Cold War?
Right now, it's. I had a hope that after the budgetary infighting in Moscow ends, and it's more or less over, the military, the party of war won over the kind of party, so-called peace, the more liberal economic part of Putin's government that was arguing that we should cut defense spending and spend more on human resources, on infrastructure, on education, or Russia will not have economic growth. And maybe downscale the confrontation with the West to get investment and technologies from the West. And Putin, during the summer, was talking about that, about possible cuts in defense spending. That has been reversed. The military have won the day. And also, in the coming weeks, there's going to be Putin is going to approve the rearmament program till 25. We'll, of course, have to see what the figures are, but it seems there also there's going to be more money for the military, more than what they wanted. I believe that after that internal confrontation in Moscow is over, maybe there could be a downscaling of the confrontation, at least the rhetoric, with the West, with the United States. That will not happen. Now, apparently, Putin will be running on anti-American rhetoric on enemy at the doorstep in his campaign. So now it's going to be postponed at least somewhere to April, May, any possibility of any detente. Maybe then, because right now, of course, no one really wants to fight a war with America, and not a nuclear one at all. This is more about getting money here, getting more power in the Putin's entourage. They talk about this party of war, party of peace. So there is still a possibility, at least if not a real detente, but at least of leveling off the rhetoric and stopping the decline into a possible, actually, confrontational mode and stabilizing the relationship. Now, I think if that could happen, that could be only late spring at best. And there's a big if about it.
Well, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and all the best to your daughter.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who's a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences and published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And then, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, he joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta, and he has a regular commentary on Russia, which appears in many local and international publications. And he joined us from Moscow. We're going to take a brief station break and back go to Spain to discuss the volatile political standoff between Catalonia and Spain following a declaration of independence by the Catalan government. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Spain is Francisco Rodriguez Jimenez. He's a professor of global and international studies at the University of Salamanca in Spain. He was a researcher at the Weatherhead Institute for International Affairs at Harvard University and a Fulbright visiting scholar at George Washington University. And his books include U.S. Public Diplomacy and Democratization in Spain and Selling Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francisco Rodriguez Jimenez.
Nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Francisco. And it's been a very turbulent time in Catalonia, starting, of course, if you go back to October the 1st with the unofficial referendum, and then on Friday, the leaders of the Catalan government, Carles Puigdemont, declared independence, and then Spain immediately fired them all, the whole cabinet, and they've called for an election now scheduled for December the 21st. But today in Barcelona, at least 300,000 people showed up demonstrating in favor of staying with Spain. So I guess if you go back to the referendum itself, I think 43% of Catalans voted in the referendum, and they voted overwhelmingly to secede, but 43% is less than half of the population. So are the people that are demonstrating today in Barcelona the silent majority, as they say over here?
Well, certainly, it's difficult to be precise these days, as you wisely described, with this turbulence and this, battle of information between the two sides. But to answer your question, as for today, riot, the police, the local police figure are 300,000, but then some other sources, which I think are probably a bit more reliable, say about a million of people. Anyhow, the thing is that regardless of the exact figure of the demonstration today, the Catalan society is divided. It's divided approximately by half. Mm? I wish a bit more of people are against the independence, but let's say that 40 and 60 could be, I would say, more accurate figure. The problem now is how to restore the goons in between the two sides of the Catalan society, as I say. And then as for the independence, the Declaration of Independence itself, paradoxically enough, is still not official, because any declaration by any government, self-government or a state, should be then included in the official text. And so far, the Catalan government hasn't done that, probably as a strategy for, let's say, whatever future movement. And, well, there are a lot of uncertainty. What will happen on Monday? I don't know if you want me to continue talking or you prefer to ask a specific question, because as this is quite embroiling, maybe we could divide topics, or I don't know how you want to organize it.
Well, no, let's just continue the conversation. And my sense is that, you know, we've already had an example of an ill-considered referendum in Kurdistan, which may result in the end of the Kurdish autonomy in the north of Iraq. And I'm wondering about, you know, are there irrational passions involved in all of this, as they appear to have been in Iraqi Kurdistan? Let's talk about nationalism. When you say it's a roughly 50-50 pro and against independence, how would you measure the level of nationalist passions in terms of on the Spanish side and on the Catalan side?
Well, first, I would say that the example that you mentioned about Kurdistan is a bit different with the Catalonian one, mainly because the percentage of Kurdistan people living in, is true, in different states, Syria, Iraq, Iran, are majority, with figures up to 90% or 95%, they would love to have an own state. In this case, in the Spanish case or Catalonia cases, it's quite different because, as I said before, so far, majority of the population is against it. Catalonia has 7.5 million people, and the last election, those are reliable sources, approximately only 2.5 or 3 million people voted explicitly for parties that had in their agenda the independence. So here is the problem, that although the narrative or the story told outside could make people think that they are the majority, is the other way around. They were, to be fair, they were quite good selling their messages to international community or international media. The thing is that now this is triggering, and also you mentioned that, this is triggering the probably side effect of fostering nationalism in the Spanish side, which was more Latin, you know, or more silent before. And of course, and also you mentioned that, when we discuss about nationalism, the first thing we should bear in mind is that it's almost everything about emotion or feelings, not about ration or objectives. And I give you an example. In terms of economy, if Catalonia continue being independent, well, the first problem that they will face is how that economy, which is strongly intertwined with the Spanish economy, just for you to understand, around 80 to 90% of the products produced in Catalonia are sold not to Euro or not to US or not to, let's say, China, but to the rest of Spain. And here, the emotion again play an important role. There are already some boycott against Catalonia product, which I think is unfair, and that shouldn't continue. But it's what people in the Spanish side is apparently willing to do. So for Catalonia, in terms of economy, be quite difficult, if not a disaster, to be independent. If you try to rationalize with them about economic things as this, they will always say that, well, not now, but maybe in the future, European Union will recognize us, United States recognize us, or let's say China will recognize us. If that will happen, maybe there would be a possibility for them to be viable state. But the truth, so far at least, is that nothing as this seems probable in the horizon. For instance, today, I don't know if you read that news. Well, yesterday, I think, was the United States that declared that they will not accept Catalonia as a new state. Today was China. Friday was European Union. And even a state, let's say, as Kosovo, no? Which is also embroiled in a difficult situation with ex-Yugoslavia and so on. One might think, well, maybe Kosovo will accept Catalonia independence. So far, hasn't happened. I don't know what the future would bring.
Sure.
But to sum up, with those international recognition, the ability of Catalonia as an independent state is just very, very difficult, not to say impossible, to see feasible, no? Because it's a very small state, no? If it will become a new state.
So to try and understand then what the grievance is on the part of the Catalonians who want independence, and we've made clear in these demonstrations today in Barcelona indicate that they are not a majority of the population of Catalonia, but they are in charge of the government, even though the government has been disbanded by the Spanish government. The Catalans have had their own parliament, their own police force, they've had their own public radio and television, they've had the control of culture, environment, communications, transportation, commerce, public safety. The Spanish government in Madrid is obviously in charge of foreign affairs, the armed forces, and the fiscal policies. What is the basis of then their grievance then, since they do appear by most standards within European countries to have a great deal of autonomy?
That's a very difficult question to answer, because of course they will have a probably different interpretation of what I'm gonna say now. If you look to the issue, to Catalonia's recent history from a historical perspective, nowadays, well, temporarily now, supposedly, the government was fired, was seized. But before that to happen, Catalonia had more self-government than even some part of countries which are federal states. The Spanish constitution supposedly and theoretically is not, it doesn't entitle the country to be a federal government, but in practice, the self-government of Catalonia, but also Basque country, is so large, so generous, that they only lack, as you mentioned, international recognition and the army, and well, and the currency, which is in this case in hands of Brussels. So, as for the grievance of the past, we could talk about, well, long history starting in 16th to 15th century, but that is a long story and we don't have enough time. But let's put it briefly and say that during Franco regime, of course, they suffered grievance against their culture, their own language, which was banned. But to be fair, another part of the story that they usually, well, neglect or they don't recognize is that Franco regime, paradoxically enough, also benefited the region, benefited Catalonia. Why was that? Franco, who was aware of that distinctive culture and, well, the will for self-government and so on, basically what he did is to foster previous industrial complex there. As a result, many people from other regions of, let's say, Andalusia, Extremadura, or Castilla-La Mancha, they moved there as migrants, you know, because there were more factory jobs there. This was during the 60s and 60s. So the paradox was that while the culture or the language was banned, the Franco government helped the economy of Catalonia. This was, again, during the Franco dictatorship. Franco died in 75, and then the constitution, new constitution, democratic constitution, was passed in 78. And there was a transfer of power from Madrid to Barcelona. And from that moment onwards, they recovered their own institution, the language. The police, for instance, now the police, the Mossos, probably you heard that word, the Mossos, which is the self-government police in Catalonia, they didn't exist before. They were created in from 78 onwards, indeed as a transformation of the central-oriented police, which was then disappeared in Catalonia, and their own police, the Mossos, took the power. The same applied to the language. Now, and I think that is positive because Spain is diverse, and I think that's difference are good for the whole country because it's rich country with this different background. So that language, which is now talking by the majority of the population with certain age, let's say the young population especially, that didn't happen before during the neither Franco regime and neither, let's say, 19th century, because, well, it happened in, let's say, rural areas, but in the cities, the Catalan language started to, if not disappear, to be more reduced to only a few people. Whereas during the recent period, they recovered that culture, that language. And I think, again, that is positive. So the grievance, if you look in a historical perspective, took place during Franco regime, but not after the constitution was passed, because the democratic constitution is quite, again, generous with the regional government, which in practice is federal. I mean, as I say, mm-hmm. in spite of, I mean, the army, as you mentioned, the currency, and that's it, because at the same time, for instance, they also have international so-called embassies. I mean, they are not embassy as if they were a state, because they are not, so far at least, but they had the right, and they did, as I say before, successfully. They have international representation, let's say, Peru, Argentina, or United States, and they have their own cultural program there, sometimes competing with a Spanish embassy. And I think, mm-hmm. to a certain point, that was fair. I mean,
sure.
The problem is when you want to go farther, no? And farther is just to have a state, and then you have to balance pros and
right.
cons.
And that's the mess that we're in now. But just
that's the mess.
Yeah, just in the last couple of minutes, the Spanish government were very heavy-handed in trying to stop the referendum in the first place, and that a lot of people around the world saw that.
In my understanding, that was a mistake, a serious right. mistake by the Spanish government, indeed.
Right. But now they have faced with the choice: do they arrest Puigdemont, the leader of the Catalan independence? I think some officials have been arrested and are in jail. That's my memory on it. But Belgians have offered asylum. So, will the Spanish government continue to be heavy-handed, or can they show some subtlety here?
We will have to talk tomorrow or Tuesday, because tomorrow is supposedly the day in which they will decide. No, I mean, not the government. This is also important to stress. Tomorrow, there will be a decision, not by the Spanish government, but by the Constitutional Court, which is important to distinguish. Before October the 1st, I think it was Hamlet, basically, because that was a not proper, no legal referendum. Had that happened without any police intervention, then probably we will not be talking now. Because there are also some figures, let's say that, well, we have to waste some more time for historical studies alone, but some figures or some authors argue already that more people started to go to vote that day after they saw the images of people being repressed by the police. It's also true, because in this information battle, as I mentioned, as I say at the beginning, there were some fake images of police repression. I don't want to say that all of them, but some of them were fake, and they were, you know, seeded by Twitter or by other social media, because there was a chaos of information. But to sum up, if the government could have handled that October 1st more kindly, more softly, they could probably have voted less people, more probably, and the result would have ended up in no direction to the goal that they want to achieve, because now more international attention, especially media and radio, is there because of October the 1st. What will happen tomorrow on Tuesday? I don't know. I hope that the court decide with the margin of maneuver they have for the softer version of the possible measure, because the stronger measure you implement, the more assets you give nationalists to portray themselves as victims of repression.
Right. Well, look, we'll have to wait to see till tomorrow. We can only hope that Rajoy, the Prime Minister, has changed his tactics a little bit and is being a little more restrained.
That has been a very huge surprise for Spain. And there are some rumors, probably you heard too, that measure was probably directed from Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mariano Rajoy is known to be not very quick taking decisions. So
right.
Everyone was so surprised that the election has been announced for December 20.
Right.
And that's why people argued that measure maybe has been suggested by Brussels as a way to change quickly the scenario, trying to calm down things.
Right, right.
And let's see what happened in December 20. Now, what will happen is that the government in Catalonia, they have a dilemma. The dilemma is, should they vote in that election or should they boycott it?
Mm. Well, we will wait and see. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay.
Francisco Rodriguez Jimenez.
Sure.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
And again, I mean, speak with Francisco Rodriguez Jimenez. He's a professor of global and international studies at the University of Salamanca in Spain. He was a researcher at the Weatherhead Center for International Affairs at Harvard University and a Fulbright visiting scholar at George Washington University. And his books include U.S. Public Diplomacy and Democratization in Spain and Selling Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.